Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is brought to you by great listeners who donate to the Peter B. Collins Show, including Robert Bracken, Larry Duers and his wife Janet in Costa Rica. Looking better all the time, Mr. Expat. Also, Deborah Hoover and Eileen Weber. Thanks for voluntarily subscribing to the Peter B. Collins Show. If you'd like to help, just go to peterbcollins.com and click on the tab on the right-hand side. Our voluntary subs start as low as $5 a month. When Bush lost his second midterm, he called it a thumpin'. Obama called it a shellacking. And I say, what have I done? This is a first of a two-part series of reflections about the midterm elections. Robert Perry will join us in just a moment. And later in this podcast, Wake Forest University professor of politics David Coates will talk with us. And then if it all comes together, our second episode will be released later on today or over the weekend. And that will feature Tim Carpenter of Progressive Democrats of America and also Jeffrey Feldman, who is the expert on language and framing. And he'll rate the Democrats on how well or poorly they did in getting their message out. Clearly, it hasn't been that effective, but we'll find out from Jeffrey his thoughts on some of the specific things that didn't work or blew up in their faces. Robert Perry is the longtime journalist who publishes at consortiumnews.com, and he is the author of Fooled Again, among other books. Neck Deep. I'm looking at my bookshelf across the way here. Neck Deep was his trilogy about the Bush family. And, Bob, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's always good to talk with you. Before we get into the big picture here, I just wondered if there were any races for House or Senate in your neck of the woods. You're based in Washington, D.C., that you thought my listeners on the Left Coast or in other parts of the nation might want to be aware of that you consider to be significant.
Well, I think there are some, obviously, that people probably do know about. The Perriello race down in southwestern section of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Perriello was the first-term congressman who ran in a district that's a bit odd. It had Charlottesville in it, which is fairly liberal, but it was surrounded by some of the old Confederacy in that part of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And it has traditionally been represented by essentially unreconstructed Confederate and racists. And Perriello was able to eke out a small, narrow victory 2 years ago. He voted with Pelosi and Obama on most of their major legislation, but he did deviate some to be a bit more conservative on some other votes to fit in with his constituency. And he and Obama went down personally to campaign for him, but Perriello lost. Some on the left had targeted Perriello because he had voted for a war funding bill.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of the cases where some on the left felt that it was better to take someone like Perriello out than to even if it meant having a right-wing Republican come on in.
Mm-hmm. But that's symptomatic, too, of the if we look at this in terms of the building blocks for Pelosi's speakership, they were all pretty wobbly, heavily blue dog. The people who were recruited first by Rahm Emanuel and then by Pelosi herself, often ran in very conservative districts that had not voted Democratic in a long time. And a lot of people were swept in on the wave with Obama in 2008, but that did not hold. And so in many respects, for me, at least half of the losses are not surprising. They were relatively red districts that, were anomalous when a Democrat won. So the harder part, though, is to see some great progressives, and most notably Russ Feingold, swept out of the Senate by a Tea Party guy in Wisconsin, which is a state that has always been thought of as quite liberal. So I think that some of this was predictable, and others certainly came as a surprise to me.
Well, I think there is this other element that the American left is institutionally and structurally very weak. There has been now for 30, 40 years now a disinterest on the left in general to build media, to build think tanks, to build the kind of infrastructure that the right has invested billions and billions of dollars in. And so you have this telling effect over time, which is that people hear a message from the right, and they hear it consistently. They hear it when they go up and down their radio dial. They hear it when they turn on Fox News. They hear it reflected in much of the mainstream press, which has tended to bend that way for career and financial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So since you don't hear much from a progressive point of view, a lot of Americans don't really understand the reasons why they should support a progressive agenda. And I think that was particularly telling in the Midwest. You get places like Ohio, which is a state that's still pretty dependent on the auto industry for a lot of jobs. They essentially punished Democrats who supported efforts to bail out and save the auto industry and voted in favor of Republicans who were determined to essentially kill the auto industry if it couldn't stand on its own two feet. So you have this sort of odd pattern of a lot of blue-collar and middle-class, especially white men, one should say, voting against what appears to be their personal interests. And I think the only way to explain that is that they are swept up in this media barrage. I was traveling from northern New York down to Washington a couple weeks ago, and it was late at night. I was trying to stay awake, so I was listening going up and down the radio dial, and I was stunned by the variety of right-wing talk radio. It's not even just that you end up with a Rush Limbaugh or a Sean Hannity. It's people I never heard of with national programs, and that's all you can really find if you're looking for any kind of political talk. So I think what you end up with is the fact that the left is institutionally weak, and so it can perhaps win with some charismatic character like Obama, but it doesn't really have the staying power. And once that the shine of the Obama mystique is rubbed off, and it's probably rubbed off by all the highly negative attacks on him,
mm-hmm.
combined with his own miscalculations and inept behavior at times.
Yeah.
But so it's a mixed bag. But after that's gone, there isn't much standing. And on top of that, you had in January the Supreme Court ruling that opened the floodgates on secret corporate donations for these attack ads. So overall, I think you're in it's a difficult situation, and obviously combine that with the fact that the economy was a total mess. Obviously, when Obama took over, he's not been able to really fix it in 2 years.
But so, he also I think one of his biggest failures, Bob, was to pin the economic debacles, and they're plural, on his predecessors. He does it in a vague way. You know, the car is in the ditch. But he, even in the heat of this campaign, was reluctant to point a finger and say it's Republican policies that cratered our economy, and I had to come in and pick up the pieces. And I think that, our televised media in particular offers no historical context, even back as far as 3 years, to point out what the root causes of the problems are. Also, the media does nothing to call out the hypocrisy of these Republicans who are now deficit hawks once again. They took a holiday all the way through the Bush years and approved huge tax cuts, borrowing to spend to pay for wars that were unnecessary. And now with what appears to be a straight face, they lecture Obama on deficit spending and the need to balance our budget. And so we have this combination of factors. And I want to read you an email that came in from one of my longtime listeners in the state of Michigan. His name is Russ, but his email name is Frank Zappa. And I always get a kick out of that. He says, hi, Peter. Talk about a kick in the nutsack. This past election was so deflating. I felt for a long time that nobody truly represents me anymore politically, and it's getting worse by the day. This whole world seems like it's spinning out of control, not going to a nice place at all. It's strange because all I want is freedom and the chance to have a comfortable life, just enough to get by. He said, I just don't get it. How the masses eat all the bullshit fed to them as the right-wing Pied Pipers lead them to the abyss. I guess I didn't want to believe my fellow citizens are really that stupid. And this is one of the problems. We had stupid candidates, people who were proud to be morons, who would never be admitted to a Mensa meeting, even as a server. And they were embraced as if they are visionaries who want to return to the simple old days, Bob.
Right. Of course, the old days they're talking about are is the early part of the 20th century, when the United States was really run by a handful of robber barons who had bought up all the politicians and controlled the economy, and the vast majority of Americans lived in something close to servitude. They had very few rights on the job. They worked 7 days a week. They worked under horrible conditions. There was child labor. There were no protections for consumers. It was pretty much buyer beware. And that's this model age that the Rand Pauls of the world want to go back to. But what is stunning, and I think it does go to this whole media deficit problem that the left, I have to criticize the left here, that it has not addressed in a serious way. It was only early this in January that the wealthy progressives decided to pull the plug on Air America, which, no question, had its shortcomings and faults and needed better management and all the rest of it, but it could have been built up into something quite important. Instead, it was considered expendable. And I think when you're faced with these kinds of situations over and over and over again, and when the right invests heavily in disinformation and propaganda, and the left chooses to just assume people are going to figure it out on their own, you end up with these problems. And the problems have grown to a very critical stage at this point. And I'm not quite sure, unless we sort of as a nation get lucky and the economy somehow, there was enough done by Obama's stimulus and enough done by the Fed or whatever to somehow spring back, I don't really see how there's much that's going to happen to fix things in the next couple of years. I could have seen, not that I expected it, but there was, you could sort of envision, if the progressive Democrats had gained more seats in this election, and could then come back and maybe if they'd run against the obstructionism of the Republicans, as you suggest, and then come back and improve the health care bill, you know, put in the public option, or added more stimulus and done more with infrastructure, that was at least a feasible way for the country to address its problems. Instead, it did this other thing, which empowers the obstruction, which brings all this anti-empiricism that the Republicans have embraced back into power, where they won't believe in global warming, for instance, won't do anything about that crisis. And I think now it's hard to even picture how you get out of the mess. And I think I share your criticism of Obama and his failure to make his message clearer. However, I think it's a bigger problem than just one man. I think it's a problem that we've all sort of shared in our inability to address these structural problems that have been building up in our nation 30 years. A lot of this, to me, goes back to the Ronald Reagan period when he put the country on this course, which was, you know, to essentially cut taxes on the rich, build up military spending, attack the unions, move to deregulate industry in an aggressive way, leading to much of the trouble with the banks and so forth, which, of course, which Democrats contributed to. That's certainly true. But the impetus, the original pressure for this comes strongly from the Reagan administration of 30 years ago. And that's why I think there's been this three-decade drift and pattern, and it's just now been added to with there's been more fuel put on this fire.
Well, you wrote a powerful piece the day after the election, and I'll link to it in the show file. It's at consortiumnews.com, and it's headlined, U.S. Voters Drink Reaganism's Kool-Aid. And you make a series of powerful points, Bob, that I have no argument with. And that is that Reagan started this trend that liberalism is evil, that government is bad, government is the problem, and you know, we need to reduce it. All the while that is a charade for the huge buildup in the military-industrial media complex, as many people now refer to it. And, you know, the call or the plea to free markets is usually a call for the rich to get richer and not a true effort to permit or promote competition in industries. And so these factors have metastasized going forward, and we're now in this bizarre world where any kind of taxes are considered evil. And here in California, at the ballot, our voters had the good sense to reject two corporate candidates in Meg Whitman for governor and Carly Fiorina for Senate, to reject a ballot measure that was put there by two oil companies from Texas, to kill Schwarzenegger's only real legacy, which is the climate change legislation that he passed. And also we had an insurance commissioner who won despite heavy spending by the industry for his opponent. So voters can smell that corporate agenda, and they largely rejected it. At the same time, they rejected a ballot measure to save our state parks, which are a real jewel of California and a magnet for tourism, one of our major industries. And voters rejected an $18 a year addition to the vehicle license tax, which would have paid for the parks free and clear and given everyone with one of those license plates free entry all year long. I mean, it's better than the season pass to Great America or Disneyland. And yet voters rejected that. And so we have this ongoing sense that even when you prove it to people that your taxes are not particularly that high, that all taxes are evil and are to be opposed at every step, yet people have great expectations of what government should be doing for them in terms of services and education, et cetera.
Right. And I think it's a huge problem. This disconnect from the real world, I think, got going in a big way with Reagan, and it was the government is the problem mantra. And what's really behind that is that we have, for all its problems and all the shortcomings of government, and I'll be the first to criticize them, but there is this point that the only way that big money can be checked in the American system is with a democratized and energized federal government. Some state governments do, but mostly the federal government. There has to be a way of checking the excesses that come with big money and corporate power. And individuals can't do it. And at this point, the unions have been so broken down that they can't do it. The only feasible way of checking that is with a democratized government, which represents the interests of the people and of the society as a whole vis-a-vis some of these corporate giants. But the corporate giants have been able, using this sort of faux populism of Reagan, and which has now been passed down through the Gingriches and the Limbaughs and all the rest of them, to convince a lot of average Americans, especially a lot of white guys out there, that they ought to throw their lot in with the corporate masters. even as the big powerful, the big money boys are picking their pockets. So when you have that kind of a disconnect and you're not able to convince people to even stand for their own interests, even understand their own interests, then you have a structural political crisis. And I think this election really drove that home, and that no one charismatic political figure like an Obama, even if he did make all the right steps, which he didn't, can counter that bigger difficulty.
And Bob, let me quote, because David Sirota, I think, is a bright guy, and in his syndicated column, he summed this up in one powerful paragraph. He said, a president who helped corporate interests gut the very proposals he was elected on, health care reform, Wall Street regulation, and economic stimulus, was suddenly berated for being anti-business and for overreaching, an anti-establishment, anti-corporate, anti-NAFTA, anti-government Tea Party, ended up electing to the Senate a congressman's son, Rand Paul, a pharmaceutical lobbyist, Dan Coats, a Bush trade rep, Rob Portman in Ohio, and a corporate chieftain whose business was propped up by government grants, Ron Johnson, who beat Russ Feingold in Wisconsin. Meanwhile, a country that twice rejected Bush Republicans in favor of Democrats suddenly returned those same Republicans to power.
Right. I think the big story here in this election was not the Tea Party. It was the victory of the corporate Republicans.
Yeah.
It was actually the Tea Party that had a very mixed result. Obviously, Christine O'Donnell lost in Delaware because of her wackiness.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon Engel in Nevada lost because she was too zany for the folks out there. And we saw this happen in several other places where if a corporate Republican had been running in those races, the corporate Republicans probably would have controlled now the U.S. Senate, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what the extraordinary story here, and this goes to the strength, their institutionalized strength, that even after the 8 disastrous years of George W. Bush and all that he left behind, in less than 2 years, the corporate Republicans have reorganized, restructured, and have with the exact same policies that they professed to believe in for those previous 8 years, are now riding high and heading back into power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an extraordinary political story, how the American people could have reached that conclusion. And I think the only way you can understand it is to look at how our media has become this propaganda factory with very few voices willing to stand up and speak against the conventional wisdom, to tell the truth, to go against the vast money that's being poured in on one side, where the other side has to struggle for nickels and dimes.
And Bob, one of the things that troubles me further is that in President Obama's post-election news conference, he sent very clear signals that he's ready and willing to compromise with the uncompromising Republicans. And in particular, on the extension of the Bush tax cuts, I'm not patting myself on the back, but I predicted back in July that Democrats would ultimately cave and extend all of the tax cuts, including $750 billion worth for the very wealthy, the top 2 or 3% in this country. And he also signaled once again that he's ready to negotiate with himself. He no longer talks about climate change. It's called energy. He wants an energy bill, he said, and he coughed up more nuclear power, which I'm deeply opposed to, but I would accept as part of a real compromise where he extracted real Republican votes for something. But we see a guy who has failed to lead, even on a cut-and-dried issue like repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where more than 70% of the American public, including almost a majority of Republicans, agree that this is a senseless policy that should go away. And an activist judge here in California gave him an out, and he didn't take it. He sent his Justice Department to appeal the judge's order, which would have declared Don't Ask, Don't Tell unconstitutional. And now he clearly can't get it through in the lame duck session and has openly homophobic candidates who have been elected to the new Congress that starts in January. And so I just feel that we saw a real remarkable lack of personal leadership on the part of President Obama on health care, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on climate change, and that it's only going to get worse as he basically has signaled that he is going to compromise with Republicans without setting any markers, saying, well, I'll compromise with them on reasonable things, but when they're doing the bidding of billionaire extractors, I'll say no.
Well, I think basically he has no power really to do much of anything. Now, it may be like what Clinton did, which was to sign on to some various some bills that the Republicans wanted, like NAFTA, for instance, and that could get through. But when it comes to anything that would be considered progressive, that is now dead. And I think that's not entirely Obama's fault, obviously. It was the voters elected a Republican House of Representatives and put a lot more Republican senators in. So it was also the voters' fault for making those judgments, and the media for its role in basically misreporting and hazing Obama, much like they did Gore in 2000. There was a Nicholas Kristof's column last Sunday made the interesting point, which I tended to agree with, that the mainstream media does treat those kinds of sort of smart Democrats in this hostile way, as almost like they're being hazed. And they did it to Gore, and it helped get Bush into the White House in 2000. And they did it to Obama, and Obama's reaction has not been good. You're right. He's tried to compromise. He's tried to bend, get something through. But whatever he does, as you pointed out that other column you mentioned, whatever he does, he is still attacked by the mainstream media as well as the right-wing media,
right,
for being anti-corporate, even when he's done a lot for the corporations, anti-wealthy, even though he's helped the wealthy. The stock market today is at two-year highs,
mm-hmm,
which means that it's at the same level that it was when Obama was elected. In other words, when it was sinking under Bush, Obama's been able, by helping to stabilize the financial system, to bring the stock market back. But he gets zero credit for that from the wealthy and the people who are invested in the market, and he's still considered anti-corporate. So what we have here is he's sort of caught between various rocks and various hard places. And he's not, I think, he's made many tactical mistakes, and I've criticized many of them. But I also think he faces a structural impossibility,
mm-hmm,
to make to actually do what he actually might want to do and do it effectively, considering all the various forces. And those forces are now a lot stronger today than they were a week ago.
Robert Perry, always great to talk with you. Thank you, Bob. And I want people to go to your website, consortiumnews.com, to read your commentary piece. And also, you could use a little financial help these days. I see you have a matching grant opportunity available. So since the Democrats and the left don't support independent media like Consortium News, I hope you will in their stead. Bob, we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Peter.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. They've got the entire Ronald Reagan bozo thing. I'm sure you can get it. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies. That's Bonzo, not Bozo. I apologize to clowns who may have been offended. On DVD and VHS, just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. And to get free shipping on any order, just enter the magic letters PBC in the comments section of their website order form. We continue with our post-election analysis from the midterm election on November 2nd. David Coates rejoins us today. He's a professor of politics at Wake Forest University. David, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you're there in the southeast in red country. And before we get into your analysis of the national impact, I'd like to get your comment on some of the races in your part of the nation, particularly the victory of Marco Rubio in Florida. With that three-way split of Charlie Crist running as an independent, I still was surprised that he grabbed such a huge margin and so early. And he is a very extreme candidate.
Yes, he is. I've spent the morning just listening to and working on his acceptance speech, which is in terms of its oratory extraordinarily powerful, and it makes you think that they may have got themselves a new star coming out of this very conservative wing of the Florida Republican Party, because his own personal story, of course, is a perfect example of the American dream, rags to riches, and he was generalizing that out as something that was available still to the vast majority of Americans, which clearly all the other data we now have suggests, of course, is not the case. So here we have another fiction writer, as it were, coming at us from the Republican side. And
well, and he paints his picture as the son of refugees from Cuba and refers to the Cuban Revolution as an accident of history. I think that's a very interesting depiction of that. And I would say that he is now an accident of history, at least from my comfortable perspective 3,000 miles across the country.
Well, he's lucky that, in fact, the vote split, because I take it if, in fact, there had been one candidate against him rather than two, then both the margin would have been different. Probably his take would have been smaller.
Yeah.
But that was never a possibility once Chris couldn't work out what he was and did not fully withdraw.
Yeah.
It's just part of a broad sweep down here. I mean, in general, certainly in North Carolina, the incumbents have held on. There have been very few changes of personnel, just one congressional district in my state that's still up for grabs.
Well, and I stayed up late, you know, just hoping for the surge for Alvin Green in the Senate race against Senator DeMint.
Yeah. You are a very, very bad sleeper, aren't you? Really? no such luck. But, I mean, quietly, as about... You spotted, at the level of states, the Republicans have done incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
And here in North Carolina, for the first time in over a century, the Republican Party will now control both houses, both the House and the Senate, at the state level.
Yeah.
So the damage which that could do, potentially enormous.
Mm-hmm. And in South Carolina, they traded an Appalachian trail walker for a woman who's accused of infidelities. And she's a far right, I guess she's embraced by the Tea Party, but more of a Sarah Palin creature.
Yes. I mean, we could take her conversation two ways, couldn't we? Clearly, there's something in the temperature down in South Carolina which makes for a certain kind of activism in the political class. But the more serious point, of course, is that what's happened this time is that the conservatives who've won are genuinely, seriously conservative, much further to the right almost universally than were the conservatives who were defeated in 2008. And they're pulling the whole Republican Party with them. And clearly they've tasted blood now and they're going to want a lot more. So I do think we're in a very serious situation, that the center of gravity being pulled away to the right. And until and unless a coherent counter pull is established, the situation looks rather bleak.
Mm-hmm. Well, and David, I want to turn now to a piece that you sent me with three powerful but simple points of advice for the Democrats, given this significant loss, and particularly the loss of control of the House, where appropriations bills originate, and where much of the original legislation is written. And let's go through these point by point, because I think, as I say, they're very powerful. First, you suggest that Democrats need to prepare for defense, to defend Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare and other programs that are now derided as government handouts and socialism. And my estimation is that the Democrats don't play offense or defense nearly as well as the Republicans do, speaking purely on a tactical level.
Yes, on the problem with Democrats have had in the last 2 years, of course, is that expectations were very high, but the governing coalition that was there was very weak. And so it was a large part of Obama's politics seemed to be spent herding the cats, as it were, trying to get people into line. Republicans in their in opposition mode and with their very coherent and simple solutions to all questions were able to offer a kind of very powerful ideological counterblast, which is what has cost so many Democrats their seats this time. Now that the Republicans are in with this very strong Tea Party element inside, and now that we've seen that Blue Dog Democrats are just as vulnerable, in fact more vulnerable to electoral rejection than Liberal Democrats, I mean,
yes,
the parameters of the possible have shifted a bit, but clearly the Republicans are definitely going to go after some of the most important institutions of the American welfare state, and they're very serious about this. And we've got to be ready, I think, to defend not just healthcare reform, but start fighting again the erosion of Social Security. And but the Obama Commission, which he set up last February, which is due to report in December, which has Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson as its chairs,
right,
is likely to be a nightmare.
Because defense is off the table, so any of the cuts have to come from domestic programs and entitlement programs, even though Social Security itself is separately funded, that will not stop them from calling for what they'll say are reforms, but will likely increase the retirement age like France did in a very noisy process, and also see various cuts in benefits before we see a lifting of the FICA contribution cap, which artificially limits the contributions to the Social Security Trust Fund to the first $100,000 or so of personal income. And so you're correct about that. And I want to come back to the overarching question here, because Democrats do not have the kind of party unity that the Republicans have demonstrated, particularly in the last 2 years, where they stood up and opposed even policies that they had promoted and put their names on and bills they had co-sponsored, because the order came down from Mitch McConnell or John Boehner, we are against this. And so every Republican dutifully voted against those measures. And we can't expect that from the Democrats. The one difference that I want to single out is that Nancy Pelosi did stop George W. Bush from his effort to privatize Social Security.
Yes.
And that was the best defensive play that I've seen from the Democrats in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yes, but this time, of course, the initiative to deconstruct Social Security, at least at the margin, will actually be coming from a bipartisan commission created by a Democratic president. So I think the task of defending Social Security will have to be is that much more difficult and will have to be made against the Obama White House if they go along with this kind of salami-like strategy of wearing away at what are called entitlement programs in the name of fiscal austerity. I have problems at so many different levels with this, as I'm sure you do, Peter. The fact they're called entitlement programs at all,
tax
the language against them. These are things that people have paid for and saved for. They don't come anywhere near the kind of private pensions that CEOs walk away with on a daily basis and so on. So actually, I think the very notion that somehow this is an entitlement that people should not have is part of the battle that we've got to engage in, to say that this is part of an American civil rights and these civil rights are being taken away.
Well, and David, we've seen that Democrats really were ineffective in challenging the flat-out lie that came from the most extreme Tea Party candidates, that even unemployment benefits are some kind of a government handout. We pay every week in a deduction from our paychecks for unemployment insurance, and we are entitled to those benefits. Now, government has extended benefits for some people who've been chronically unemployed, and that is, certainly beyond the insurance that they paid for. But fundamentally, unemployment benefits are not an entitlement, not a giveaway, not a handout. They are insurance coverage that each individual worker has been paying for during their working career.
Yes, they have. And the underlying premise of the onslaught on unemployment insurance is that people voluntarily stay unemployed, and that the more you extend the unemployment coverage, 99 weeks and so on, the more you take unemployment up. And I had a horrible lunchtime yesterday with a very reactionary person from the Cato Institute who was saying this as though it was a matter of fact, whereas what we have here is about 8 to 10 million Americans, maybe slightly more, who are involuntarily unemployed from no fault of their own, and who can't get back to work because the economy is still so stagnant and private firms are not generating a little bit of extra employment this month, but pathetically tiny amounts of extra employment against the loss of jobs that has gone on. Now, then I think the Democrats have got to turn around and say to the Republicans, well, actually, are you in favor of people starving in the streets? What happens to them, their families, their children? Is that what you really think America should be? in the second decade of the 21st century. But the minute they've got away with the rhetoric that we're just into budget cuts, but the specificities of those cuts have been avoided. It's time now to get them to put detail on the page, and I think their support will fairly rapidly erode.
And David, we had the bizarre scene here in California where billionaire Meg Whitman was running. She spent $160 million, most of it from her own personal fortune, to try to buy the governorship.
Yeah.
And yet she was lecturing welfare families and saying that she wanted to take welfare benefits and redeploy them into the state university system that has been badly battered by the financial failure here in California and bad government. And so that appeal did not produce any cries of hypocrisy or, you know, it was not described as class warfare. Class warfare is when the unions spent money to announce their opposition to Meg Whitman.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just amazing how...
We could do with borrowing the French working class for a while, I think. I mean, just to remind us of a kind of history of American labor, because if we go back to the 1930s, the thing that sustained the New Deal was CIO militancy across the whole of the Northeastern and the Midwestern industrial belt. It was because the organized labor movement was so assertive industrially and politically that the space had to open up in Washington to do the kind of decent and necessary things that were essential to get out of the Great Depression. I think over the last 25 years, 30 years, American labor has been battered economically and battered legally, of course, but also critically, ideologically.
Yeah.
But people now don't get mad. Or if they get mad, they blame themselves or their neighbors instead of getting angry about the sheer ripoff that's going on at the very top. And that taking of the national income at the top is what's squeezing everybody all the way down. And I for one, again, wish we had a more assertive labor voice in this conversation. We
mm-hmm.
try and get that back if we can. I mean, it's bad enough in California. You should try it in North Carolina. I mean, it's almost totally silent here. This is a right-to-work state. People don't even have the right to join an organization.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do understand that. Your second point in your postmortem is called Forget Bipartisanship. And I wish you had reached the president with this before he gave his news conference on Wednesday midday.
Yeah.
Because once again, he is reaching out to people who want to cut off his fingers.
Yeah.
And Mitch McConnell has made it very clear that he'll compromise with the White House as soon as they come in his direction 100%.
That's right. His notion of compromise is total surrender.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Let me say something to you, Peter, about that. I had two thoughts that cross each other on that one. The first is this. There were two votes on last Tuesday. There were the votes of people who voted and the votes of people who didn't. You know, 29 million people didn't go to vote who voted for Obama or the Democrats in 2008. And the message they were sending was a rather different one, that they were so disillusioned with what had happened that they couldn't be bothered to get going this time. So Mitch McConnell walks into the room and says he speaks for the American people. He only speaks for that part of the electorate that went his way, which was more than the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the whole silent majority that the Republicans used to deploy to justify their programs in the past actually is there in the wings waiting to be remobilized if, in fact, there was a leadership from the Obama White House that actually had some backbone to it. That was my first thought. And the second was this. I take it in the immediate aftermath of this kind of vote, Obama was not able to go out and say, well, the hell with it. We're just going to go on and disregard it. He has to at least stretch out to the Republicans to begin to demonstrate that it's they, not he, who are playing the partisan game. But I just hope he understood that it was a tactical move. The sense I took, perhaps you took too, was, no, this guy really believes it. He really believes he can get bipartisan deals again. And
well, David,
where is he?
David, I expect the kind of, when you lose an election like that, you don't come in with boastful and arrogant statements. But the president could have put limits on his willingness to compromise and say, for example, when he was repeatedly asked about the extension of the Bush tax cuts, including those for the ultra-wealthy, he signaled he basically didn't put any lines around it.
No, he
didn't say, well, I'm willing to compromise on behalf of the middle class, and I'm willing to listen to any ideas as long as they're not coming from the billionaires who have fronted and who have funded the front people of the Tea Party movement. And so he didn't put any limits on it. He didn't even require that it be rational in terms of the deficit reduction that Republicans claim they just ran on.
Yes. No, he did not. And a powerful counterframe to this Republican onslaught is absolutely vital. If he's going to take it as, I got it all wrong, and it was a personal vote on himself, then I think, hubris and egotism in the White House is going to get in our way. There was a Barack Obama that excited us all in 2007 and 8, who did go out and challenge. And I think we need that Obama back, because if we don't get that Obama back, we won't have a president at all. And for the moment, at least the White House and just about the Senate is not in the hands of these very conservative Republicans. But if they sweep in 2012, they then will do what they promise, and the consequences will be truly horrendous.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that he's not willing to acknowledge that he's heard, and he said he did a lot of listening during this campaign in backyards and on factory floors, is that the Republicans are unified in doing anything and everything to defeat him in 2012. And so to imagine that there's any common ground with the Republicans between now and then is sheer lunacy. And yet he sounds those themes as if Olympia Snow and a couple of other moderate Republicans are just waiting for, the 50th time that he asks to drop their guard and, put the country before their party politics.
Well, I take it what they're thinking in the White House, you and I are not party to it, but one could guess that they think they've got two potential constituencies they have to get back. They've got their base, the people they couldn't mobilize this time, but they've also got these people who call themselves independents, we had a 16% take on them last time, and the Republicans reversed that, didn't they,
mm-hmm.
this time. So if you're sitting there as a kind of pollster in the White House without a brain between your ears, you would then say, well, we've got to tack to the center to make sure we pull those independents back. But my sense is that you turn the Democratic Party into a party that's acceptable to independents. What you've got to do is go and persuade independents to become Democrats. And unless you've got a very powerful counter story to tell the one the Republicans push so effectively, then the independent vote will, hearing only one coherent package in town, will stay away on the right. So both independents and the base need to be captured again by a strong, progressive Obama who challenges the nonsense that comes from Republicans on a daily basis. I've yet to hear him say, perhaps I just missed it, that the kind of deregulated market philosophy you offer as a solution is what got us into this mess in the first place. And if you're simply offering us a repeat of what we've already gone through, that, if he says that over and over again, people will start to hear it, I think.
Well,
bipartisanship will be impossible.
He uses the metaphor of the car in the ditch, but he is loath to blame specific Republicans or even the party in general for the policies that wrecked our economy.
And he does use that analogy, which they use, of the family budget and the federal budget as though these two things are the same.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the critical thing. I mean, it makes perfect sense, somebody with no economic training, to say, oh, yes, I've got to balance my budget. Why don't they balance theirs? But any notion, any Keynesian notion that you can use public sector deficits to get the economy going when the private sector is stuck as it's stuck now,
yeah.
That's just not in the equation. Well, if it's not in the equation, then the case for big government in economic terms is being sold in the silence.
Mm-hmm. David, the third point you make is pretty common to most people who follow sports in America. The best defense is a good offense. And it is important for Democrats, even in the minority in Congress, and even with the mindset that we're seeing displayed by the White House right now, to continue to fight for signature initiatives. And this is one of the problems I've had with the Democratic Party, is that they've been unwilling to stand for something important and lose in doing so.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you send a very powerful message to people in your base and others inclined to support you, including those pesky independents you just referred to, that, oh, these guys actually want to do something that I believe in, and therefore I'll support them at the next election. And the Democrats have just been so risk-averse, whether in the minority or in the last 4 years in the House in the majority, to really take risks that that do have a potential downside. And critically, they should have forced the vote on the tax cut extension, the Bush tax cut extension, before the election, and not punted it to the lame duck session.
Well, let me just, I agree with all that, as usual. We're normally 110% in agreement. Let me give you a little more optimistic scenario. Just remember what happened when Scott Brown won last January, and so suddenly they couldn't do their 16 votes in the Senate, and they stopped some of their backdoor dealing, and they became much more assertive in pushing through the health care bill than they were being before. The White House is in no position now to deliver anything. It won't get anything through the House that it wants. It's going to have to spend most of its time making sure that what the House wants doesn't get through the Senate and the White House. So, in a way, the best defense is offense. They've got to become much clearer on about what they want and draw some lines, because if they don't, then the level of alienation against them is going to increase. And I have this view, which perhaps you share too, that there are two kinds of Republicans coming at them now, and they've got to make sure that they both split them, but they also speak to both sets of answers. The standard Republicans who think that the big stimulus package was a mistake, they can have one conversation with them. But these Tea Party people who think we want to get rid of government altogether, the Libertarian wing, mm-hmm. need to be addressed separately. And I think those are two conversations that the White House has got to start having with the American people, loud, long, and clear, as quickly as possible.
Indeed. Well, David, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your commentary.
Thank you.
Let's be in touch, and we'll talk about this as the soap opera continues.
Indeed. Let's hope for better times soon, yes.
All right. David Coates at Wake Forest University. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Email your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.